Okay, the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy will come to order. And do you have minutes to sign? Representative Lane moves the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay, we will start with House File 622. Representative Marquardt.
622.
Want to come up? You're not going to sit backwards to us? Hey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
State your name. Go ahead. Just go ahead.
Very good. Well, House File 622 would establish a Minnesota Youth Council Committee. And back in 2002, 4-H program was celebrating its 100th anniversary. And they had a national conversation. They went all sorts of places. And the number one goal that came out of for youth out of that conversation back 11 years ago was to involve youth directly in creating policy and making decisions at all levels of government. And House File 622 does just that. What House File 622 does is kind of formalizes, institutionalizes a youth committee here in the legislature. And not only would it give youth a direct voice in the legislature, but it also would give legislators a direct connection to youth. What this would do is formalize youth input. It would also effectively serve this unique population. Remember, to be elected to anything in Minnesota, you have to be 21. So until that age, and many states are 18, but in Minnesota it's not until 21. So you really have an age group where people do not have people they can directly elect for their age group. What this bill does, it would set up a youth council. There would be a total of 36 members, four from each of the eight congressional districts, plus four at large. There are, as of 2011, at least 12 states that also have a youth council formally set up by their legislature. And membership ranges from 16 in North Dakota to 112 in New Mexico. So this would be a 36-member board. What's nice is we don't have to sit and reinvent the wheel. We have a group, a Minnesota Alliance for Youth, that already does all these things. In fact, the members would come from the Minnesota Alliance for Youth, which has been came about through America's Promise, if you remember that, back in the late 1990s. They already have the criteria for the selection. They would actually run this committee. Now, you might ask, okay, if you've got the Minnesota Alliance for Youth, why do you need something in statute? And I would say that this would formalize and kind of institutionalize youth input here at the Capitol. And the way it would work is that it would require this committee to meet at least twice during the year while we're in session. And the way it would work is there would be two or three times during the session they would meet in a committee. They could call up bills that they see are of interest and ask legislators to come forward to present their bills. They could propose bills and actually put together an omnibus youth bill that, of course, another legislator would have to carry. There's other duties that they would have, but it goes beyond field trips. It goes beyond mock legislatures. This would give youth a legitimate voice under the Capitol dome, so to speak. And so that's the premise of the bill. I do have some testifiers, including the president of the Minnesota Alliance for Youth, Sarah Dixon, if she would come forward, and a couple students who will give, all of these will give quick testimony. And I think there might be also one more testifier that might be interested, too. So I'll turn this over, if that's fine, Mr. Chair, to Ms. Dixon.
Ms. Dixon, I know
Hi.
You, and so listen to him, short.
Okay, yes. We'll definitely be short, Mr. Chair,
because
members of the committee.
He's been entertaining for a long time.
Yes. He's been sitting when I am long-winded. Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this legislation. This bill reflects our strong commitment to the importance of providing young people opportunities to bring their voice to the legislative process. and to support and inform policy decisions, particularly those that impact youth directly. The proposed bill will formalize the relationship between the Minnesota Youth Council and all of you to ensure youth voices integrated into the legislature. Representative Marquardt alluded to our founding. We were founded in 1997 as a result of the President's Summit when all the living presidents and their wives, led by General Colin Powell, and Minnesota specifically led by the Lieutenant Governor Joanne Benson at the time, to launch this initiative in Minnesota, and we've been honored to work with all the Lieutenant Governors since then. And the goal of the summit was simple, to mobilize every sector of American life to build the character and competence of our nation's youth through a five-promise framework that all young people need and deserve: caring adults, safe places, a healthy start, effective education, and opportunities to give back. And this framework is proven, research-based, that we know if all young people, especially those with greatest need, have all five, they do much better in school, less likely to be involved in crime or victims of crime, avoid teen pregnancy, and other high-risk behaviors. Our organization fundamentally believes in the power of youth serving alongside adults. In our name, Minnesota Alliance with Youth, we know that far too often young people are viewed as recipients of services or as having problems to fix, rather than being part of the solution, as being powerful assets and resources. In an effort to change this, the Minnesota Youth Council utilizes a youth and adult model. You will have the opportunity to hear from our members shortly. We are uniquely positioned to support this statewide council. We've got a strong and diverse network of over 500 strong that represent individuals, organizations, associations, schools, and communities across the state. More specifically, we've just joined efforts with the Out of School Time Intermediary Youth Prize and Youth Thrive, another statewide organization, to help provide funding and training that we provide to all youth and adults in our council. We've additionally developed an innovative partnership with the Minnesota Department of Education that will allow a unique opportunity for the youth council members to have a voice in the crucial part of their life, education, and actually impact the system itself, which we believe can again serve as a model for other state agencies to replicate. As Representative Marquardt alluded to, we've already recruited a very diverse and committed council made up of youth and adults from each congressional district. We have highly qualified staff that provides extensive training and support for our council. We're proud to have bipartisan support for our work at the local, state, and federal level, and we also have the necessary funding and infrastructure in place, so we're not asking for that. We believe that Minnesota Alliance with Youth cannot do our work without young people, and neither can the state of Minnesota. A recent survey from the council indicated that 47% of young people feel they have no power to make change in their community, and a more startling 33% said they had no idea how to make that happen. So through the Minnesota Youth Council and with your support, we fully intend to change that. So I thank you again for your support and opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you for being short. I know it's tough.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Ms. Dixon, you convinced me the other night. I'm going to lay over my bill till next year and make sure that you do what you said as far as including all youth, because that was my bill. In the past, we've seen the stars always on these committees. So go ahead, Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would like to thank you for this wonderful opportunity. My name is Kelly Timian, and I'm a Title I paraprofessional at Augsburg Fairview Academy Charter High School in Minneapolis. Young people in Minnesota are incredibly bright and creative thinkers that have much to offer the world. Serving as an adult sponsor for a second year, I'm profoundly inspired by the shared ideas, actions, and passion of the Minnesota Youth Council. Youth engaging in dialogue about issues affecting youth has played a valuable role in bringing awareness and perspective to our communities. Equally important are the subsequent actions taken to address those identified issues that compel youth to undertake the initiative and responsibility necessary to effect change on local and statewide levels. The exchange of knowledge is extremely powerful, and I have witnessed several meaningful exchanges among youth and adults driven by the Council's goals. These exchanges manifest the value of authentic relationships that give youth a voice in decisions that will impact their lives. I have watched not only my student council members, but other students with a desire to engage in and understand the legislative process grow from inactive to active contributors to the communities in which they live and attend school. It is my personal belief that these youth will continue to work towards building solutions and strengthening communities throughout their lives. The passing of this legislation would demonstrate our commitment to ensuring that youth are valued and equal partners in Minnesota's future. Thank you for your time. Okay, and then.
And then she has
this letter.
I think we'll just file it.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can't. We've got a big calendar.
All right. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak in front of you this afternoon. My name is Amy Vu, and I've been on the Minnesota Youth Council for about 2 years now, representing Congressional District 4. And it has allowed me different opportunities to pursue the things that I'm passionate about, closing the achievement gap and lowering the high school dropout rates. As a little girl, I have always had this passion and love for humanity, and that each and every one of us has a societal responsibility to work in solidarity to help one another. And so the Minnesota Youth Council has been that group that is focused on moving forward and addressing these issues. There are a lot of different perspectives at the table working on these youth issues. And the NYC is not just focused on one type of student, but each youth council member is one piece of the larger puzzle that makes up who we are. If it weren't for the NYC, I wouldn't know what it's like living in rural Minnesota or what youth issues are there. The diversity of the group is one of the things that I absolutely love about it, and I get to hear other people's stories and backgrounds and how it has shaped their perspective. During our discussions, we have many different perspectives that allow us to address these issues with an open mind and an open heart. It's like the legislature, a group of diverse people who represent different perspectives and people, and the NYC tries to mirror what it's like in our council. With this motivated group of youth and adults, it has given me the opportunity to foster my passions as a young person, to pursue the things that I love. It has shaped who I am. Not until recently being here, I was able to figure out the framework as to what I like to do. It is about my passion for being in an environment like this at the Capitol, to work in public policy and to make change at the government level. The NYC has a domino effect in my life, and being one of the first fallen that pushes the other dominoes that creates different opportunities, like pushing me to apply for the Minnesota High School PAGE program and really learn what it's like to be here. All in all, it has allowed many youth perspectives to be heard, and I strongly believe that it would only do good for the legislature. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone that wants to testify in opposition to the bill? Yeah, I was going to go to questions. Question, Howell. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question goes to the how this was, you know, how the youth are able to apply, how they're notified in these congressional districts of how they get a chance to apply and how they get noticed of this, and what groups they worked with. You know, do they, you know, I've got a special leaning towards the Minnesota Youth Teen Program, mm-hmm. and do they get an opportunity to provide their membership to this organization, and how that all gets broadcasted and how they get a chance to apply.
Ms. Dixon.
Great question, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We do a rigorous recruitment process every summer for the next year, and we have, as I mentioned in my testimony, hundreds of partners. So we make sure that the Minnesota Teen Council, is that what you're talking about? The teen?
Minnesota Military Teen.
Military
program.
Teen would be invited to apply. We're working with the Commissioner of Education on children of military to make sure we had that representation and the minority councils. The goal is to have as broad perspective as possible.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is, as you say, you've already got these people selected, and that raises my concern that here you've already got the folks selected, and we haven't even formalized the process or anything to have these folks get a chance to apply. So,
sure.
And what I would, as an add-on, what I'd also like to see is I'd like a list of those folks,
sure.
of those organizations that have already been actively engaged.
Sure.
But I that's my concern. You've already got the selection made. That raises the red flag to me that this is already a pre-done thing coming in.
And sure, and Mr. Go ahead. Do you want to take it, or
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Howell, we're rather than reinventing the wheel and having to go out and find people to recruit and do all this, we already have the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, which has been very successful in place for over 15 years. And yeah, right now they're functioning, and so when we were to adopt this, it could be all new members as they go through the process. So, I mean, they're already in existence, and we're just plugging into that system, which I think, as very good as far as getting recruitment. And I don't know of another organization that could get as widespread recruitment as they do. But the terms also would be 2 years and staggered terms, and you could serve for twice and so forth. So there's going to be quite a bit of a exchange on it. But no, nothing's, I mean, we're just plugging into this, so that's why the members are in place right now. But depending on when this would go into effect, it could be totally new members.
And the chair renews his motion to pass House File 622 and refer it to GovOps. Is that correct? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Norton, do you have somebody from Rochester on one of them? Okay, we'll take that one then.
Chair, I move House File 1338 be passed and be referred to K-12 policy.
Okay, then, Representative Martin, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would ask an author's amendment just to remove Section 1, please.
Representative Martin, do that to give shape the author line.
So moved, as the author wishes.
All in favor to get in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, I'm disappointed to have to be here today, but we had an incident recently in Olmsted County in the Rochester Public School System where a student was physically pushed around in a building. It was some time before the family found out about the incident. And it was interesting because the law that was cited for not telling the parents was, I think it's called Kyle's Law, which we just passed several years ago, for the very purpose of making certain that parents were notified when something happened at school. And so we're just trying to add a little bit of language that makes it clear. And so you'll see it simply is one line that says whether or not a report of child maltreatment has occurred, if an incident occurs, that the school shall inform the parent, legal guardian, or custodian of the child that the incident has occurred that may constitute maltreatment. And I have some people here that can talk about what happened, but when you have a child that's vulnerable, and in this case it was a child with autism who was handled improperly, when an incident occurs and a family isn't notified, there are repercussions often with the children at home. And in this instance, it took, I think, 6 days or more before the family was notified that it had happened. And you can have a reaction from the child and a family not understand what has happened. So there's more involved in this particular case. We're not addressing that at all. We're just saying, I think the intent of Kyle's Law when it was passed a few years ago was that parents were notified. It did not happen, and we just want to make certain that no family is put in that position again. And so I have Brad Trahan with me from Rochester.
Thank you, Mr. Trahan. Go ahead. Just state your name and then go ahead.
Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Brad Trahan. I'm the founder and executive director of the RT Autism Awareness Foundation in Rochester, Minnesota. For full transparency reasons, I'm also chair of the Minnesota Autism Task Force. And most importantly, I'm a parent of a son with severe autism. In spin-off to Representative Norton's comments, the bottom line is when something happens of an alleged misconduct to our kids, 50% as it relates to autism are nonverbal. If an incident happens at a school setting where Main Street kids are going, they can come home and tell their parents what all happened. In the case of kids with special needs and our 50% of the population with kids with autism, they can't speak. They can't tell us what happened. In this case in Rochester, five students reported it to necessary administration, and then 6 days went by before the parents were ever notified that an alleged misconduct happened. As parents, we have to make decisions. We have to take a look. Do we have some behavioral issues going on? Are there any other underlying medical conditions that we need to look for? Is there any evidence we have to look for physical marks and whatnot? And we have to make decisions. Are we going to send our child to school the next day until we can get the full analysis of what happened? It's not the intent of this whatsoever to find out who the person was, if it was a student or staff member. We just want proper notification as parents to find out what happened so we can address any medical or behavioral or social needs of our kids prior to sending them back to school.
Thank Are there anyone want to testify opposition? Or okay, then Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, I'm wondering about the phrase may constitute maltreatment. That seems pretty broad.
Representative Norton.
I think it is broad purposefully because we want to make certain that we're not waiting until after the incident has occurred and a decision has been made. We want, if it's possibly going to be charged or there's a possibility of it, that just the parent be notified that it might occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe, you know, there's some legal interpretation here, too. But my issue is how many incidents is that where, you know, may constitute maltreatment? Do you err on the side of reporting every single potential incident? And what is, I mean, what's the description of the cutoff? And you could say there's a common sense level, but I'm concerned about the legal liability of school districts under this statute.
Representative Norton.
I certainly appreciate that, and this isn't about a parent pressing charges. It's about a parent being notified that their child has had an incident at school. And I guess as a parent myself of four children, if any sort of incident, whether it be bullying or something has happened that had happened to my child, I would expect that school to notify me so that as a parent I can talk with my child, and it may be nothing further than comfort.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to push it any further, but it's just a concern I have, and maybe there's some advice to be had on that.
Representative Reinert, I'm not sure. It's going to K-12 policy. I don't know. You're on that, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
So maybe you can get
talk about
an
it.
And answer
I
before
would
then.
Be very open to talking with you about it.
Okay, Representative Krishna?
Nope.
Okay, then. Okay, then Representative Lane renews her motion to pass House File 1338 as amended and send it to K-12 policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Representative Dean. Chair will move House File 510. We think it goes to jobs. Is that correct?
I think that's what we're thinking.
We're sure it has to go to jobs, and we think it might have four other stops, but we're not sure. That'll be my motion to send it to jobs, and if we find out different before the floor when we pass it to whatever committee, we'll change.
Sure.
On the floor, and members, this committee only looks at Section 3. So all of your marks would be directed to Section 3, the Youth Apprenticeship Program. Just go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sorry if I'm short on breath. I just ran up from the basement. Well, if I'm only speaking to Section 3, I think one of the critical things that this bill does, it begins to have us consider relative to youth internship and apprenticeship programs that we're approaching a gray tsunami. And we need folks that are trained and ready to enter into jobs not only within the state but in other areas as well. What this bill does, it also takes into consideration the shifting demographics in the state of Minnesota. So it does focus directly on emphasizing youth with disabilities and targeting youth who are at risk or economically disadvantaged. It also requires all public contracts over $100 million to include a youth internship or apprenticeship component with, again, the emphasis on youth with disabilities or targeted youth who are at risk or economically disadvantaged. And that's a significant piece of this bill relative to your purview.
Okay. Does anybody else want to testify on this bill? Then are there any questions? Okay, the chair will renew his motion to pass House File 510 and refer it to the Jobs Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm running back down to the basement.
Thank you.
just tell.
Is Abler here? I think we'll go to something else then if he's not here. Is Abler out there? No? Okay. Okay, we'll take the other Norton one that has to go someplace next. I believe it's 1121.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move House File 1121 be passed and be referred to Health and Human Services Policy.
Thank you. Representative Norton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill has three sections. The first section involves some data sharing, and then I'll go into some a little bit more specifics. But what we're hoping, the whole point of the bill, is to improve early identification and treatment of children on PMAP.
Just a second. Representative Norton, in looking at the bill, I think the only sections that we have jurisdiction of in this committee is from line 630 to 72 and from 732 to 815. So if you could just put your testimony to that. And then
no, that's just what I'm getting to, Mr. Chair. So that works well. I'll just put the top one away. The point of the bill is to try to identify and improve screening, diagnosis, and treatment for young children from birth on that have autism spectrum disorder or other developmental disabilities. We are seeking to have the department do some data collection. And so perhaps we'll just let Ann Henry talk a little bit about that section. And she does have a handout for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Henry.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead.
My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. And we represent children and adults across Minnesota with long-term significant disabilities. And we have certainly represented a lot of adults with autism and a lot of families who have a child. And I really want to thank Representative Norton for all of her efforts to improve early services for young children with autism. The data that that you're getting now, I think, really portrays why we support this bill. We really think we need to do better in our low-income public health care program because we have a growing crisis with the diagnosis of autism. We are now up to 1 in 88 children, according to the CDC, and 1 in 54 boys. This is data from 2008, so we're afraid that it might be even higher. We also know in Minnesota, in a recent report issued by the Department of Health, again from data 2009 and 10, that our state is below the national average in identifying children before the age of 4. Early identification, of course, is crucial because that's when we can make the most difference in terms of improving the child's function. Minnesota showed up at 31%. Other states, on average, were at 50%. This bill focuses on prepaid medical assistance, and so I think it's important to realize that in the birth to 21 age group, which is the smallest age group I could get for children from the Department of Human Services report, 27% are in fee-for-service, but 73% of these children in this early group are in managed care. And that's why we need the plans to do a very good job right away. If you turn over the sheet, a new report, still in draft but about to be finalized from the University of Minnesota to the Department of Human Services, shows some of the disparity in our program. 21% of the children with autism spectrum disorder who receive long-term supports in that early group, 0 to 5, are in the category of Black and African American, while that group is only 5% of our population. The next chart shows the difference between identification of ASD, or autism spectrum disorder, in fee-for-service and managed care. Now remember, well, fee-for-service has over 1,000, managed care has 953. Remember, managed care has 73% of the children. We think this indicates there's room for a lot of improvement. And finally, if we provide early services, there can be not only improvement for children and families and less suffering, but long-term savings because of the cost of special education and long-term care. So the bill establishes a withhold, which is withholding capitation until the plan meets performance standards, which would be established by the Department of Human Services. And we think the department's well-resourced now with 4 new reports from a variety of entities on autism spectrum disorder. And then also it sets up an initiative to really focus attention and try to engage the health plans to do better. We really need them to do as much as possible at this point in time. So I ask for your support.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to testify on this? Okay, are there any questions? Okay, then Representative... Oh, was there a question?
Yeah.
Where?
Testimony.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see.
Yeah, it's not about that section, but you might do it.
I'm sorry. Robert Freeman from the representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I didn't quite catch when you were talking about which section of the bill you were still looking at.
I wanted to talk about the last section before.
We're only talking about... section, well, lines 6302-72 and 7.32-8.15. Those are the rest of them aren't in our jurisdiction.
He was concerned about section two.
I'm sorry. So this last section, section four, and then which, yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Section two is not. Where's the end of section two?
Yeah, there's a withhold, and he's concerned about the withhold.
Okay, then there is I don't think...
Line 6. The withhold is not in our committee. That's
okay.
Above.
Then I guess we'll save I'll save my testimony for HHS.
That's also in a different committee.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Other questions? And Representative Lane renews her motion to pass House File 1121 and refer it to HHS policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Norton, we'll take your 395 now.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Wait a second. Somebody has to move it.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, move that House File 395 be passed and referred to Jobs. And Economic Development.
Representative Norton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We were approached in Rochester by some members of families of adults and children with high-functioning autism or Asperger's. And what they told us was our children don't qualify for services because we're very high-functioning. And what our children, and they were children, they were adult children, but what our children need is to be able to work and live independently. And we think with a little support, they can do that. And so the Department of Economic Development engaged and Olmsted County engaged, and we've come up with an idea for a pilot program, and we're hoping to get some funding and it would be for one FTE in the Olmsted County area that will actually work with employers and the employees to try to give job support for these individuals who don't qualify for any of the programs that most of us are familiar with in our communities to keep them employed and being taxpaying citizens, be able to perhaps live on their own or with a little support. But these are individuals, there were many in the room who said, I want to keep a job. We know they're taken advantage of often at work by other employees. And we know sometimes they just don't understand the rules or take them literally, and so have a hard time keeping employment. And so we think with this little help, we can prove to the state that with a tiny bit of investment, you will have workers that will stay employed and pay taxes, and we think that'd be good for the state of Minnesota. And if it pays off, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to have other folks across the state implement something similar.
You answered my question. I was just going to ask.
So I do have the SIL, the director of SIL, state SIL is here, and he'd be happy to answer questions, and Deed also has a representative.
Maybe just answer questions so we can, I know this is real popular bill, so if you want to just come up and either do you want to just answer questions or
absolutely.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Brinage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just generally, I'm wondering if this pilot will partner with any of our existing organizations that do serve underserved populations with special needs, because we have a wide range of employment opportunities for adults who need special training, and I would think we would want to take advantage of some of their knowledge and skills.
David would be happy to talk about this.
Absolutely.
Because his organization...
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is David Hancox, and I'm the executive director at the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. I'm here today at the request of my colleague and friend, Vicki Dolly Molly, who is the executive director at the Southeastern Minnesota Center for Independent Living. She unfortunately could not be here today because of illness. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Center for Independent Living in Rochester has a long history of working collaboratively and cooperatively with a wide range of other organizations in and around the greater Rochester area. So my assumption is that in the context of this particular project, that would be carried on. In calendar year 2012, the Center for Independent Living in Rochester served nearly 25,000 individuals with wide-ranging diagnoses of different disabilities. So this certainly, again, falls within that context. So.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up, it actually was the SEMSL, or Southeast Minnesota Center for Independent Living, that actually houses the nonprofit parent group and brought us this issue. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. No other questions? Okay, then. Representative Lane renews her motion to pass House File 395 and re-refer it to jobs. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, no.
Thank you.
Representative Abel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will move this one, on which I am a co-author, House File 890.
Health policy.
They requested it.
To pass and be referred to Health and Human Services Policy.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Gabriel, I suppose you have an A1B193 amendment. Is that
That's right. That's our amendment, and it's the first committee, so if the committee could put it in order, we can discuss it.
Representative Abler, that's your author's amendment.
That's correct.
Put it in the shape you wanted it.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay, then all in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great bill. It's got two really good authors, and just pass it. But maybe you want to hear some testimony first. I'll defer to my witness in the interest of time. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Don Iles. I am the Division Manager for Human Services in Anoka County. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. House File 890 proposes a pilot program that would transfer the responsibility for licensing of all child care homes in Anoka County from Anoka County to the Department of Human Services. Today, there are two types of child care facilities located in Anoka County and throughout the state. They are commercial child care centers and family child care homes. In the case of the commercial child care centers, the state does the required criminal record checks of facility staff, makes site inspections, and follows up on complaints that are received concerning the operation of the child care center. The state has the authority to issue a child care license. In addition, the state also has the authority to suspend or revoke these licenses if necessary. In short, in the case of commercial child care centers, the state is responsible for every aspect of licensing. The responsibility for licensing family child care homes in the very same communities is significantly different. The counties are mandated to do the background record checks of those individuals living and working in the home. The counties are also mandated to make the site inspections and to respond to complaints that are received concerning the operation of the home. All of the information that is collected by the counties is subsequently submitted by the county to the state. The state, in turn, reviews the information submitted by the county and makes a decision as to approving the license. Only the state has the authority to issue the child care license. In addition, if there is a complaint about the operation of the home, the county is mandated to investigate the complaint. The results of that investigation are also forwarded to the state, and the state, in turn, has the authority to revoke the license if it is necessary. As you can see, the methods of licensing commercial child care homes and family homes in the same community are significantly different in regard to both responsibility and efficiency. In addition to creating a more efficient and effective system, this bill would also address the unfunded mandate that exists today for counties in this area. Counties are mandated today to provide the services I previously described for family child care homes, but we are also limited by statute as to how much we are allowed to charge the child care homes for this service. Current law limits the counties to charging an annual fee of $50 for licensing inspection and an annual fee of $100 for background studies. In our case, in Anoka County in 2012, we generated just over $71,000 in fees for this service. The total cost to deliver the service, however, was $692,000, which leaves the Anoka County taxpayer paying the difference of $621,000 between their revenues and expenses. This represents an unfunded mandate for a service that the county is providing to private businesses within our communities. We are often asked to identify unfunded mandates that exist at the county level. This would seem to be a prime example. The proposed legislation would require Anoka County to transfer funding from the county to the Department of Human Services for providing the licensing services. The first payment of $310,000 would take place on July 1st of 2014. That is the same date that DHS would assume the licensing function from the county, according to this bill. This payment of $310,000 is half of what it costs Anoka County to provide this service in each year. In short, the county would provide the service the first half of the year and then would transfer our funding to DHS for the second half of the year. The bill outlines the schedule of payments that decreases by 20% per year over the next 5 years, and after January 2019, DHS would be responsible for the funding. The bill also requires the commissioner to propose a fee to the 2015 legislature to recover the cost of delivering the service. The report that is required in the bill would require DHS and Anoka County to provide the legislature a report in 2018 comparing the efficiency and effectiveness of the pilot program compared to the current model of county oversight. The report would include a recommendation as to whether the pilot program should be continued or expanded to additional counties, as well as a recommendation for fees necessary to recover the cost of oversight. The home child care providers will experience a transition from the county to DHS should this bill become law. Today, those providers have what I believe is a good working relationship with their licensing worker and with the county. I would expect that a relatively seamless transition from a county licensing worker to a DHS licensing worker will take place in much the same manner as the transition that takes place when one of our county workers retires or changes jobs. The licensing standards, rules, requirements, and fees would remain identical to what is in place today. In summary, I believe that this bill addresses both the efficiency factor that would be gained by consolidating services within a single state structure, as well as addressing an unfunded mandate that exists at the county level. Should the bill become law, Anoka County would work closely with the Department of Human Services on implementing these changes and assessing their effectiveness. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. And members, it's anything like fees and that or any kind of labor issues aren't in this committee. Is there anybody that wants to testify on this bill in the audience?
Okay. Representative. Well, just a comment. I'm sure this committee has had quite a discussion about disparity between the fees and the costs, and I had never become so aware of the difference until I saw this bill, frankly, and they talked about it. And I remember when they got reduced, I think I was on the committee at that time. I think there were 100 or 150. And it seems burdensome to put that on these providers, but at the same time, there's a cost, and there's a lot of liability issues. And I'm sure you've had a lot of discussions about that, given, I don't know what all you do, but I'm sure that's one of your topics you've taken up with some of the new licensing bills that have come forward. So this is our county's effort to say, here, we'll give you the money, and can you start to figure this out? So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on Mr. Burris? Is this one of the ones that there's an amendment?
Mr. Chair, actually, I have a recommendation for an oral amendment. There is in the author's amendment, the effective date of the whole section was pushed out by 6 months, but there is a requirement of notification in Subdivision 2, Paragraph A, that would take place before the whole section would go into effect. So what I'd recommend is modifying the effective date a little bit so that notification provision would go into effect right after enactment of the section. That way that notification triggering mechanism would be able to apply right away.
Mr. Burris, could you explain what the amendment would be exactly?
Yeah,
the language?
Yeah. Okay. It would be page 2.
Of the bill? Or of the amendment?
This would be of the bill to amend it. Okay. Page 2, line 10, before the period, insert, comma, except that subdivision 2, paragraph A, is effective the day following final enactment. So that would put that paragraph requiring notification to the commissioner of human services into effect right after the bill is enacted.
Can you repeat it, please?
Okay. Mr. Burris, would you state that again so everybody on the committee knows exactly what it is?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, it would be amending House File 890 as follows. Page 2, line 10, before the period, insert, comma, except that subdivision 2, paragraph A, is effective the day following final enactment.
The question on line 111, it doesn't make any difference if it says July 15, 2013 then?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, July 15, 2013 would then be the cutoff date that the county would have to notify on intent.
Thank you. So I move that amendment.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kerber agrees, and I think when Mr. Kerber and Mr. Burris agree, it's a good idea, so I think we should do that.
To put it in the shape that the author wants, is that correct?
It's a new way I want it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Okay. All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Thank you. Are there any, I think I asked if there's any testimony. I'll ask again if anybody else wants to testify on it. Okay, is there any questions of anybody? Okay, then Representative Lane renews her motion to pass House File 890 as amended and re-refer to Health and Human Services Policy. Is that correct? Okay, thank you.
You need to vote.
You need to vote.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I like the way to do business.
This is a good one. Why would we vote on something?
None of the pesky voting.
I'm very sorry about that. Okay, I'll state it again. Representative Lane again moves for passage of House File 890 as amended and re-referred to Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carrie, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it.
I thought you were going to stay for the rest of it on the chair.
It's a friendly.
Peter's not around. He can't come. Peter wanted to be last.
Sorry. Yeah, come on.
Thank you. lunch every day.
Hey.
Would you like to move your amendment, your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move the House File 807. Is that the one? Yes. That one goes to, is that the one that goes to judiciary? That's right. This one goes to judiciary. Thank you.
And proceed.
Madam Chair, I'll also move the DE1 amendment. Things have changed a lot, and we now have peace in the valley, so there's sudden changes in the last couple days. First, I'll move the DE1 amendment, and then I have an amendment to that to get it in the shape that we wanted.
So then that puts it in the shape you want, and we just accept that. Thank you.
Yes. Madam Chair, what the DE1 amendment would be. Change to...
Excuse me, Representative Mullery. Okay, first we'll have to vote on the delete all amendment. All those in favor of the delete all amendment to get it in the shape that Representative Mullery wants it, vote aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Amendment passes.
Thank you. And then there's a change. I'll move the change on line 110. The last two words on line 110, so such, and then delete 111, 112, and the first 6 words of line 113.
Can I just ask you which one you were looking at? The regular bill, DE1? All right, thank you.
And then line 114, the word 4 is changed to the word 3. And then on line 118, the word clauses is changed to just clause. So the S comes off, and then the 3 comes out, and the word and is also deleted. So that reads, except clause 4. And so that would be my motion to amend the DE1 amendment, so to get it in the shape the author wants.
Could you repeat that for us?
I can repeat it.
Okay.
line 110, delete such a, delete line 111 and 112, and delete the first 6 words on line 113. So you delete continuance without a finding of delinquency. Then on 114, you change 4 to 3. And on line 118, you take off the S on clause. You take off the S on clauses at the end of clauses. And then delete 3 and the word and, so that it reads, except clause 4. Better be sure that Mr. Burris has it exactly.
Well, Mr. Burris? Okay.
Got it. Okay.
All
so
right,
that's
then.
Just to put in the shape
all
of
right.
the offer.
All right. Then we'll accept that.
Right.
Go ahead. Explain your bill.
Do we need
yes.
a vote?
Oh, okay.
On that,
yeah.
We shall vote on the oral amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion passes.
Madam Chair, and then things change fast here. What was totally not agreeable on Friday has suddenly become agreeable to the parties. And so there's a A13-1 5-0223 amendment to the DE1. And I would move that at this time to get it in shape the author wants.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Thank you. Passes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'll explain what it does. And then what this is the regular DE1 is for stays of adjudication. And what happens is after the this is only for juveniles. And after the child has admitted the allegations, there's a what's in procedure called a stay of adjudication so that they aren't adjudicated and it doesn't go on their record. And so we're trying to help youth who get in a little trouble with the law not be saddled with that forever and be kept out of jobs and things like that. So right now there is no language about public safety in that. So prosecutors wanted to add and not inimical to public safety, which I thought was reasonable. If the child is a danger to public safety, we don't want them out there. A lot of the other groups, including probation officers, wanted to extend what is now a 90-day stay of adjudication plus a 90-day stay of adjudication. So the total right now is 180 days. There's great efforts. In fact, MACAC, which represents the most probation officers, has been very strong in wanting that deferral so that youth can receive treatment, because most treatment programs, I'm told, are from 9 to 11 months, and some extend longer. So the 180 days really doesn't fit the reality of youth. So we're extending that, but to extend beyond the original 180 days, we're giving the county attorneys the power to prevent an extension of that stay of adjudication. So what this bill will allow is up to 3 additional stays of adjudication of 180 days each, but only with the consent of the prosecutor. And I don't know if anybody cares about it, but the except clause 3 is taking out just kind of an incarceration. They didn't feel that was appropriate. So my understanding is that the way I've stated it is what at least most of the probation officers, the Second Chance Coalition, and the county attorneys have agreed on. And so that's, I think, a really big help that we can have for youth so that they aren't saddled with the problems of an adjudication if they're straightening out their act and following through with their treatment. The other amendment, 223, just happened to an agreement around roughly noon today, I believe it was. And I believe that, well, I'm told that the MACAC, the county attorneys, and again the Second Chance Coalition have agreed on this, and it's much like the county attorneys proposed several years ago, and this is with regard to registration, and it's to get at youth are very different on recidivism and things like that for sex offenses, and so this would treat them in a different way from regular adults as far as registration. And so it's on page 3, it goes through the specifics as to as to when a person would have to register and when they wouldn't. And so it's the more serious things or if they've committed multiples. And again, this is to try and help youth that really aren't bad characters but have screwed up, straighten out their life and get ahead. So with that, I believe, I don't know who's going to testify, Mr. Kingery, are you going to?
On which issue?
On, I think you're on both. Or is there different people from the county attorneys on the different ones? Or you can both come up here. Whichever. Oh, there's another amendment the county attorneys came up with. And I will fix that. Is that the words? Madam Chair, I'll move that. It's on line 3.9.
On the amendment? On the
223 amendment.
And what line is that?
Yes, on line 3.9, before the word convicted, put in adjudicated or, and that's because on an EJJ, they could be still within the delinquency system where it's called an adjudication rather than a conviction. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And so, Madam Chair, I would move that to get in the shape the office wants. Those two words added.
Okay. And
convicted change.
Do we vote on that?
No.
Added. Okay. So that adjudicated or on line 2.9 of 223, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion passes. And thank could you identify yourself, please?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Heather Grusert. I'm an assistant county attorney in Mille Lacs County. Here on behalf of the MCAA Juvenile Law Committee. I will just speak very briefly with respect to, I think it's called DE 807, the continuance policy, and just note that Representative Mullery did work with our committee extensively and that the committee supports the language as amended today. With respect to what I'll refer to 223, which is the sex offender or predatory offender. As Representative Mullery noted, the Juvenile Law Committee has long supported an amendment to the sexual offender registration because of the adverse effects on juveniles. The committee, however, is concerned, and I specifically reference lines 3.11 to 3.16, which leaves out necessary registration for offenders who commit an offense under 609.342 subdivision 1 paren A. And what that subdivision is for victims who are under the age of 13 and their offender is 36 months or more older than them. So what this legislation does is leaves out registration, for example, a 17-year-old who commits a sex offense against a 3-year-old. They would not be required to register under this legislation, and the committee has concerns that that does not ensure public safety. I think that the spirit of this bill was to not hinder lower-level offenders who maybe because of a same-age situation or a close age, like a 12 to an 8-year-old, to hinder them for the remainder of their life. But in doing so, it leaves out very serious offenders who are taking advantage of very young, possibly very young victims. And so I would ask that this committee consider moving to amend that specific provision to include reference to 609.342 subdivision 1 paren A, or paragraph A as it's written.
And Representative Mullery, are you interested in doing that now or in judiciary?
Madam Chair, can I just this thing is moving so fast.
Is that really a judiciary item?
Is anybody, you're okay with that? the two that I see that have been involved with.
Okay, I think you'll have to do it in judiciary because we can't amend an amendment.
Oh, well, we don't. Yes, Madam Chair, the amendment is now the bill. I checked with Bill Marks, so after you got that, it's the bill. So we can amend the bill. Then.
Is that your pleasure to do it here as opposed to judiciary?
Yes, Madam Chair, the two sides, I believe, agree with that. And I actually, this language, I believe, came from the attorneys, and they apparently left off when they drafted it, that concern.
Mr. Burris, you have that? So we need it again.
It would be...
Maybe Mr. Anderson and Mr. Kingery can just confirm that on line 3.13, 609.342, subdivision 1, paragraph, add in paren A, comma, and then continue to C. And then on 3.14, it would read 1, comma, paragraph, paren A, comma, C. So it would then include the sexual penetration where the victim was under 13.
Madam Chair, I'll so move.
Okay. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion passes. And is there anybody to testify? Anybody else to testify?
I don't know any other. And I apologize to the committee for all these changes, but they've all happened with them.
And we have one more person here. I think that we'll go to a question from Representative Mellon because she wants to ask it now.
Well, I was going to ask it of the county attorney that was
up here. Do we want to bring her back up?
Sure. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Greisert. Ms. Greisert, my question would be more specific to the Judiciary Committee, but since we're here, I would like to hear from you, and it's on the DE1 amendment, which is now the bill, and I'm looking at lines 1.13 to 1.15. The continuance may be renewed for up to 3 additional successive periods, not to exceed 180 days each, but only with the consent of the prosecutor. And I'm just wondering if I'm reading that correctly, that the judge would need consent of the prosecutor in order to extend a stay.
Yes.
Could you explain to me the purpose of why a judge would have to ask permission from a prosecutor in order to extend a stay?
Currently under... in the adult criminal world, stays of adjudication cannot be entered over the objection of the prosecutor. This brings it in conformity with adult criminal. It also allows It also allows for a situation where a juvenile is not in conformity to then be adjudicated instead of continuing the stay. If you note in this bill, the first 180 days does not require consent. It would be continuing the continuance of the stay beyond the 180 days. And so it would allow further voice for the prosecutor to object, again, if the child were not cooperating or if other factors had arisen that would make the stay not appropriate in the circumstances.
Thank you, and Madam Chair.
Representative Mellon.
Are you aware of anything in law that requires a judge to get approval or consent by the public defender or a defense attorney in order to do something? I mean, if you're not, that's fine.
Not that I'm aware of.
And I can, discuss this further as we go forward, but... And, this is more specific to judiciary, but the fact that we put in statute that a judge has to get consent of one party in order to take an action, I personally find absurd. There's two attorneys. They're supposed to go into a courtroom, make an argument, and the judge bases his ruling on that argument. There could be an appeal in place, so one of the parties could appeal that decision of the judge. But for a judge to have to get consent from just one party, one side, of an action in order to issue a stay, I don't care if it's, juvenile or adult, I think that that's unreasonable. And frankly, I think it puts a defendant at a huge disadvantage where they're not only at the, you know, will of the judicial system, but also at the will of the prosecutor. So, you know, I really was disappointed to see this language. And, you know, Representative Mullery, it's not your fault. I'm sure the county attorneys insisted on getting this in there. I mean, why wouldn't they? The judge has to get their consent in order to continue the stay. But I hope that going forward and when this goes through judiciary, that's something we can seriously take a look at, because I have some serious reservations about it.
Any comments, Representative
Mullery? Madam Chair, I can see both sides on that, and it is in some places where there are requirements of consent of the prosecutor. And we've been working on this issue for, I think I started 6 or 5 years ago trying to get this through. I know talking to the person from MACAC, he says we're finally on. Let me explain. MACAC is the CCA counties, most of the larger counties, all of their probation officers. And they really want to get this through. And they're fine with this. Sarah from the, she basically, I think, formed the Second Chance Coalition. And they've agreed to this. The county attorneys have agreed to it. And so I really want to get it through, because these youth now that are in this situation, we can really help. And right now, with the law the way it is, we can't even give them the full treatment they need. And so this will allow the full treatment of the youth without getting a record on it, and so they have time to straighten out. So I really, really hope that we can finally pass this year after all this time.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up quickly, right, and Representative Mullery, I really appreciate the sort of premise of your bill, which is to allow more time for a juvenile to sort of rehabilitate themselves or, you know, not be able to put into the delinquency system so that they do have a record, because we all know that there's some serious collateral consequences attached with the even a juvenile record. So I really do appreciate you extending the time. I just think I can't think of anywhere in law where we say a judge can't do something unless the public defender approves of it or unless a defense attorney approves of it. You know, we don't say a judge can't certify a juvenile as an adult unless the public defender approves of it. I'm sure the public defenders would appreciate special language like that where they don't have to go in and make an argument, but the judge just has to get their permission or has to get their consent to do something. But we just simply don't do that. And I just want members to be aware of it. I do think that, you know, the overlying intent of the bill is good and very needed. I just wanted to bring members' attention to it. I know this isn't Judiciary Committee, but I think it's a mistake to have that language in there.
Thank you, Representative. I'd just like to say that I think I would assume that the House Research Bill summary that would appear before the next committee, the Judiciary, would reflect this conversation. And so the Judiciary Committee would be the place where this should be discussed, because I think it's over the rest of our heads, and I thank you for bringing the legal advice on that. But we can go forward at this time and take it up again in the judiciary. Is there something?
Madam Chair and members, I think there is a corresponding change to the last oral amendment that was made. That last oral amendment, as a reminder, was a reference to criminal sexual conduct, a paragraph A reference. There's already a paragraph A reference in the next clause that's on page 3, line 18. And that has a substantive implication based on some other language in the bill. So an initial look, it looks like I would recommend removal of the reference in clause 4, because it's been added in clause 3 under that oral amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to the expert on whatever he just said.
So then,
and I can read
Mr. Burris, yes.
Language more specifically, that would be page 3, line 18, to the 609.342, subdivision 1, paragraph A.
All in favor of that, to say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion passes. And are there any more? We have one more testifier. Yes, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak. My name is Bruce Hagstrom. I'm a 20-year Chisago County probation officer, and I also am the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. And I appreciate the work that Representative Mullery has done on this. We, too, have been working on this for a number of years, and the intent really is to give us more time to work with these kids. There is often multiple programs that they need to complete, and under current statute, we get 6 months on a stay of adjudication. Well, not much can happen in 6 months. So we really appreciate this effort. To speak to Representative Mellon's point, we have similar concerns. But we tried to get this done last year, and we couldn't get a hearing in the Senate because the County Attorney's Office or County Attorney's Association objected to the language as it was. The one concern I have regarding this particular, well, I have two concerns. Deleting Clause 3 in on pay, or 118. What Clause 3 does is allows the court to place a kid out of the home involuntarily, okay? We have concerns, the association has concerns about that. Under current law, kids can go to any variety of treatment programs voluntarily, all right? We use a carrot and stick system in probation. The carrot is, you get in the stay of adjudication, all right? This isn't going to go on your record if you do X, Y, and Z, all right? If you fail to follow through, then we're going to bring you back into court, and we're going to move for a disposition of delinquency, and there's going to be huge collateral consequences. So we don't see the need to delete Clause 3, all right? It just gives the court the ability to place a kid out of the home involuntarily. So that's one concern. The other concern is on the 223 amendment on lines 3.5 and 3.6. It's our experience that when anyone is charged with an offense, that's not a conviction. Now, in this language, if a person is charged with a fourth-degree crim sex, later on pleads to a fifth-degree crim sex, they're still going to be required to register, regardless of what the outcome of the case was. Even if the case was, if they plead to something less with disorderly conduct, they're still going to have to register because they were originally charged with the crim sex. So I've asked people a lot smarter than me how that's constitutional, and I haven't gotten a good answer. So those are our concerns. Otherwise, in total, we definitely support this effort, and we appreciate Representative Mullery's work on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? I'm sorry.
Is there any questions to this testimony? Representative Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering what Representative Mullery thinks about your last issue, because that seems like a pretty critical consideration in order to before moving this bill forward.
I wasn't quite sure what he was saying was wrong. I thought you were saying that the word conviction wasn't correct, because it would be a conviction if they're certified.
Right. But what I'm saying is, if they are convicted of that offense or another offense arising out of the same set of circumstances, then it would seem to me that regardless of what they end up pleading guilty to or convicted of, it's what they were originally charged with that holds the consequence.
Representative Bryant, I'd like to call a lifeline the county attorneys that wrote that.
Thank you.
Well, somebody can explain it, whoever. Somebody in your association wrote it. We got three here.
So Welcome back. State your name again. And
thank you. Heather Griesert. And as I understand, we were referring to lines 3.9
and
3.10.
3.5 and 3.6. 3.5 and 3.6. Okay. What are we doing here? He was asking if somebody was charged with a sex offense and was dropped to a disorderly or something like that.
This language on 3.5 and 3.6, this occurs when a juvenile is certified as an adult, they're prosecuted as an adult. And this is the current state of the registration laws for adult offenders. It's consistent with that, that if they are charged with a felony violation and are convicted of that offense or another arising in the same set of circumstances. So it's just making it consistent for a juvenile who has been prosecuted as an adult to be treated for registration purposes the same as an adult who had been charged with that in that type of offense.
But this doesn't say another felony offense. So if it's reduced to a misdemeanor?
Correct. And that is the state of the adult registration law.
Okay. Representative Mallory, I'm going to make a suggestion here that that we move this out of early childhood and have you continue to do this work in a venue that actually can work more closely with these issues, and hopefully by the time you get there, you'll have them worked out also.
Sure, totally agree. I think that the larger, most of the probation officers, I'm told, are trying, in fact, he's here from MACAC if he wants to testify, but he told me that in checking on with the exception for Clause 3, most of them wanted that. Okay. And so, but this last one, I think, needs to be worked on and by people that understand it better than probably, for sure, me and maybe most of the members of our committee.
On the basis of that, I just would like to see if there's anybody else in the committee that wants to comment on the overall perspective of this, and before we pass it to judiciary, will that take care of the details of the law? Is there anybody else that would like to comment? And if you're comfortable with that, Representative Mallory, I'd like to just move this bill on now.
Thank you.
All right. All those in favor of moving this bill, passing House File 807 and referring it on to judiciary, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
Nay. Motion passes. Representative Mallory moves House File 1259 be passed and referred to Health and Human Services Policy.
And, Madam Chair, in order to get it in the shape the author wants, I'll move deletion of Section 6 and deletion of lines 10.12 and 10.3.
Section 6 on page 10. Final section of the bill?
Oh, Section 6, Madam Chair.
And the other part was what?
Lines 10.12 and 10.13.
It's already crossed out.
It is already crossed out.
I'm sorry. Put those back in.
Store.
Sorry, didn't they?
Okay, Representative Mallory moves the deletion of Section 6 and restoring the language on line 10.12 and 10.13.
Madam Chair, thank you. And basically what this does, again, it's to help a juvenile who had...
Madam Chair, should we vote on that?
Oh, sorry.
All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, can I...
Yes, please continue, Representative Mueller.
Madam Chair, this bill, again, would help juveniles who have had some small problems with the law, and it would help them get jobs in industries where they need clearance from Department of Human Services. And so what it does is that right now it's a very cumbersome procedure, and I would have, if I was a juvenile and I was had a juvenile record, I go out and I want to work in a nursing home or with something like that, I have to go to an employer like the nursing home, then they have to go and check with DHS, then they get sent a disqualification automatically, and so then I can apply for a set-aside, and then if that set-aside is granted, then I can work there, except in the meantime, a lot of employers have gone on to the next candidate. And so what this would do, and DHS has this actually in their policy bill too, which Representative Abler is carrying, and it would allow me as the applicant to go to DHS first, and if I'm disqualified, apply for a set-aside, that can all be worked out so that when I first go to an employer, all of that disqualification set-aside doesn't appear. I just get a clearance to work at that job, which we hope will help a lot of people get employed. They won't get the employer moving to the next one while all the wait is going on. Mr. Kerber is here from, I think he's still here. He was here a long time ago. And like I say, this is the same language that's in the department's bill that's being carried by Representative Abler.
Thank you.
But it has to pass our committee too, the same language.
Thank
you. So that's why it's here.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kirby from the Department of Human Services, from the Inspector General's office, and I can just answer any questions people might have about the background study system, if you like.
Okay, are there any questions from the committee members? Well, anybody from the public that needs to testify on this? I think we're going to move this bill right on out.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I'd like a roll call, please.
All right. Representative Myra has asked for a roll call. Would you give a roll call, please? Mm-hmm.
Muller?
Aye.
Lane?
Aye.
Myra?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Briner?
Yes.
Franson?
No.
Howe?
No.
Creesha?
No.
Moline? Moran?
Yes.
Radinovich?
Yep.
Winkler?
Yes.
There are six ayes and five nays.
With six five, six motion prevails with six in favor and five against. So House File 1259 has been passed and refers to Health and Human Services policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the last one that I have is House File 1217, so I would move that, and I believe this also goes to the judiciary. Thank you.
Representative Mullery, hopefully we will not take up too much of the judiciary's work today.
Right, I agree. Madam Chair, this is really, it's a very technical thing, so it really is for the judiciary mainly. There was a U.S. Supreme Court decision, I believe, with Miller versus, I think, Alabama, where they said that an automatic life sentence without parole was not appropriate for a juvenile, and so they threw out a law there. They put in some conditions when you could do it, and this bill is drafted by the county attorney, so they're going to have to explain exactly what their condition is on it. This one is not yet that piece in the valley. The other two did. So somebody from the county attorney is there.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Arneson. I'm the managing attorney of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office Juvenile Prosecution Division. I'm also a member of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee. I'm here on behalf of both organizations, and we're asking the legislator to pass House File 1217. As Representative Mueller indicated, this bill will basically keep in place well-settled Minnesota policy with respect to sentencing the most heinous of murder cases in the state of Minnesota, while conforming to U.S. constitutional law based on the Miller versus Alabama case that was referenced. Last summer, the United States Supreme Court decided that case that made part of Minnesota's first-degree murder sentencing statutes unconstitutional. The Miller case said that it was unconstitutional to have a statute that makes it mandatory for a judge to give a juvenile a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. The U.S. Supreme Court did not prohibit sentences of life without parole for juveniles who commit murder. However, the court said that in any case involving a juvenile under the age of 18, the offender must be able to present and the sentencing court must have the opportunity to consider factors related to the effect of the offender's youth on his or her culpability and potential for rehabilitation. Under current law in Minnesota, as it stands now, there is a mandatory sentence of life without the possibility of parole for defendants convicted of the most heinous murder offenses. This applies to juveniles as well as adults, and it's a very limited category of murder cases. Murder has multiple degrees, and first degree is the most serious category of murder cases, and it's only certain types of murder to which the sentence of life without parole applies. And those primarily are for premeditated murder, the cold-blooded murder, intentional murder of a police officer, intentional murder during the commission of a sexual assault or a kidnapping, intentional murder during the commission of a terrorist act. This, as I mentioned, this applies to both juveniles and adults. So right now, under the United States Supreme Court, part of this sentencing law is unconstitutional. And without a change to the law, there is no clear direction to the courts on how to proceed on these most serious of cases. As part of its decision in Miller versus Alabama, which dealt with 14-year-olds, the court did not prohibit, as I said before, the use of a life without parole sentence, even with somebody as young as 14. They indicated that they expected, with the changes, that the sentences of life without parole for juveniles would be rare. In Minnesota, based on the laws that we have right now, it has already been rare. There have been only 8 individuals who are currently serving a sentence of life imprisonment with the possibility of parole for a crime committed when they were a juvenile. 5 of those were 17 at the time that they had committed the offense. One was a month shy of his 17th birthday, and the youngest was 1 month shy of his 16th birthday. I could go through each of these offenses, which I won't, but to give you an idea of what they are. In one of them involved 2 16-year-olds who murdered a woman and her 10-year-old son. The woman was stabbed almost 200 times with multiple knives that were used. The knives broke and they continued to stab her. They did this in the presence of her 10-year-old son, who watched while she was being murdered. He was restrained, stabbed, choked, smashed over the head with a television, and he also died. There was a 16-month-old that was present in the home during the time of this offense, and fortunately was not injured. We unfortunately have some of these very serious
heinous offenses that are committed by juveniles. And Minnesota's sentencing policy has allowed the imposition of a life without parole sentence. What we're asking for today is to send this on, this provision, which would provide the fix that is required by Miller versus Alabama. It would permit a court in such a case to consider the factors that were identified in Miller, and if after considering these factors the court determined that the offender's youth and potential for rehabilitation outweighs the public's interest in imposing a sentence of life without parole, the court may indeed impose a life sentence with the possibility of parole. If the legislature doesn't act to conform Minnesota law to Miller, courts will not have clear direction regarding how to proceed in these cases. There's a hole right now that needs to be fixed. Although some courts may conclude they have inherent authority to impose sentences of life without parole in these cases, others may very well conclude that they lack authority to impose any sentence at all. We're asking the court to make this fix, we're asking the legislature to provide this fix, to provide justice for our victims and our communities and constitutionality in our lives.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? I'm thinking that for the purview of this committee for Children and Youth Development, we are interested in having this pass on and look out the legal aspects and judiciary.
Madam Chair, that I was hoping, I'm not convinced either way on this. They haven't really been negotiating with each other, so I'm going to step in. Hopefully, if this committee passes it and they get it passed before it gets to the floor, we are going to have them actually coming in the room together and negotiating or something on this, hopefully.
I assume you're here to have it pass.
Hopefully,
so
yes.
On that basis, I would like to renew the motion that House File...
Is there another testimony?
Was that more testimony? Pardon?
In opposition to the bill in its current form.
All right, come forth.
Okay.
Introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Perry Moriarty. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. I teach criminal law and co-direct the Child Advocacy and Juvenile Justice Clinic. And my research and practice focuses almost exclusively in the area of juvenile justice and most recently on issues related to the Supreme Court's decision in Miller versus Alabama. I am here today to ask the committee to give the two sides more time to do what I think we should have done to date without assigning blame on either side. The sides have not spoken. Representative Mulry is correct about that. In the alternative, if the committee's not prepared to lay the bill over or to not act on it, I ask the committee not to support House File 1217 in its present form. My testimony will proceed as follows, and I ask the committee to move me more quickly if there are pieces that you've heard before or are already familiar with. I'll describe the substance and the implications of Miller versus Alabama briefly, emphasizing the points that I think are relevant to lawmaking in Minnesota right now. I'll summarize some of the legislative activity in other states since the June 2012 decision. I'll briefly discuss the legal landscape in Minnesota, most notably the fact that our state Supreme Court tomorrow morning will hear an appeal based on Miller versus Alabama and is poised to potentially decide some of the issues that are relevant to this bill. And then I'll address House File 1217 and explain to the committee why I believe there are alternatives to the bill that would better embody the spirit and letter of Miller and would generate broader support. June of 2012, the Supreme Court decided the companion cases of Miller versus Alabama and Jackson versus Hobbs, holding that mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles violate the Eighth Amendment. Miller versus Alabama was the third U.S. Supreme Court case in 7 years to conclude that three fundamental features of youth, lack of maturity, vulnerability to negative influences, and capacity for change, make children, quote, constitutionally different from adults, and, quote, less deserving of the most severe punishments. Miller-Jackson calls into question the constitutional validity of between 2,000 and 3,000 sentences across 29 states, including 8 in Minnesota.
While the Supreme Court did not take life without parole for youthful offenders completely off the table, the court recognized that the sentence will likely apply to only a very narrow class of offenders if the circumstances of their youth are properly taken into account by the sentencer. The quote from the court is, given all that we have said in Roper, the prior decision on the death penalty, Graham, the prior decision on life without parole for non-homicide offenses, and Miller, about children's diminished culpability and heightened capacity for change, we think appropriate occasions for sentencing juveniles to this harshest penalty will be uncommon. Since Miller, all 29 affected states have been engaged in a flurry of activity, as the committee might imagine. Post-conviction petitions, like the one to be heard tomorrow morning by our state Supreme Court, have been filed. Judicial decisions have been issued and appealed, and several states are considering or have passed legislation. Without going into detail, I'll give an overview of the legislation passed. Currently, Pennsylvania and North Carolina, Pennsylvania has 500 individuals subject to relief under Miller-Jackson. We have 8. And North Carolina, with close to 50, two arguably the most punitive states in the country. They're the only two states that have signed into law, post-Miller, a bill that leaves juvenile life without parole on the table as an available sentence for first degree. And I stress to the committee that's something we're considering here today. Other states, including Wyoming, Colorado, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, are poised to enact legislation, so is Washington, have all either eliminated juvenile life without parole, in fact, have all eliminated juvenile life without parole as an option, and have allowed for parole review after, the most any state is allowed is after 25 years. California allows for judicial review and resentencing at 15, 20, and 25 years, respectively. Massachusetts and Connecticut are considering allowing for parole review at 15 and 25 years, and Washington is considering the same. We are looking at leaving juvenile life without parole on the table, subject to a potential for parole review after 30 years, which outside of Pennsylvania and North Carolina would make us the most punitive state. There are currently 8 individuals serving this sentence here. Tomorrow morning, the Minnesota Supreme Court is going to consider State versus Timothy Chambers. Among the issues the court is poised to decide are the retroactivity of Miller, the applicability of Miller to Mr. Chambers' case and others similarly situated, and perhaps the procedure to be followed by the sentencing court should Miller apply. So whether there should be Miller hearings, quote-unquote Miller hearings, and what factors should be considered at Miller hearings are issues that our state Supreme Court may be weighing as quickly as tomorrow morning. Finally, as to House File 1217, as the committee knows, this bill seeks to retain not only juvenile life without parole as an option, but a presumptive sentence of juvenile life without parole, because it places on the defendant the burden of showing that the defendant is entitled to something less than life without parole. The defendant has the burden of showing these particular factors. This bill is out of step with the majority of states considering legislation in 3 major respects. First, it retains not only juvenile life without parole, but it retains presumptive juvenile life without parole. That puts us next to Pennsylvania and North Carolina. It provides as an alternative parole eligibility after 30 years. With the exception of Pennsylvania, no other state has yet exceeded 25 years. Even North Carolina has it at 25 years. And the bill includes factors well outside those prescribed by the court in Miller. The court cited the following factors to be considered in cases involving children facing juvenile life without parole: the child's age and its features, including immaturity, impetuosity, and the failure to appreciate risks and consequences, the child's family and home environment, and these are in the decision. The committee has before it these factors already pronounced by the U.S. Supreme Court: the circumstances of the offense, including the extent of the child's participation and the way familial and peer pressures may have affected his or her behavior, the child's unsophistication in dealing with a criminal justice system that is designed for adults, and the possibility of rehabilitation. House File 1217 would have courts weigh factors beyond these, such as victim and community impact and the juvenile's participation or lack thereof in child welfare, school-based, and programming interventions. Now, I completely agree that there's a place for victim and community impact in the process, but those considerations are more properly dealt with at the parole juncture, or at the charging stage, or at the certification stage.
While those factors may be relevant at other points, they are not, according to the U.S. Supreme Court in this decision, the type of factors that bear on whether a juvenile, by virtue of his age and immaturity, possesses a diminished culpability and greater potential for rehabilitation at the time of the offense. Two closing sentences, I promise. Because the decision in Miller is so important to so many states and so important to this state, and because the doctrinal implications and the legislative implications remain in flux, they're a source of intense scrutiny and debate throughout the country and here. And because the bill before you departs from the spirit and the letter of Miller and the direction of many other states in significant ways, I urge you to let us sit down and talk further about this before moving this bill forward. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
If this bill were laid over rather than moved on, how would that help?
It's dead then. Were it, this is the
Representative
last week,
so
No, I understand that, and that's the position we'd be taking. We don't, layover, perhaps I'm using the wrong parlance. We don't want this bill to go anywhere. We think that we can, with all due respect, Representative Mulroy, we think that we can do better than this, and we think the sides need to come together and do better than this. It's my understanding that the county attorneys have reached out. I am presently involved in drafting an alternative bill, as along with State Public Defender John Stewart. I wasn't aware that the county attorneys had reached out. It seems like it was to a different entity and perhaps the correct entity, but I was not aware of that, and neither were others involved in the redrafting.
Thank you. Representative Mulroy.
First of all, I wish I would have known Professor Mulroy was coming. I would have called for Sherlock Holmes, but I don't think Professor Mulroy understands that what I'm trying to do is we've got over two months, to try and work something out before the end of session.
Right.
If we kill this bill today, then we can't work anything out. What I'm trying to do is say, pass it so that it sits on the calendar and isn't brought up on the floor of the House
right.
while we try to negotiate something between the two sides.
Ms. Murray,
I do understand that, and with all due respect, I think it's okay if we pass through this session and renew discussions again in a few months. And the reason for that is the only thing that will change in the current structure is that life without parole is off the table right now. We have the factors prescribed by the court in Miller as factors that courts need to consider, and in fact, district courts here have already started to do that and decide on the issue of retroactivity for our prior cases. And we have an available life sentence that is constitutional within the current scheme that can be awarded.
You said that we've talked a lot about brain development, and we know that age 26 is when the full brain development is done with full executive function. Mm-hmm. This seems a bit premature to me. I'm starting to worry. Is this moving in the Senate?
My understanding is it's not. There have been discussions in the Senate, but my understanding that nothing is moving.
Okay, and Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mulroy, it seems to me that part of what our problem here is that your committee is a little bit of a unique conglomeration of issues that we don't typically have here. I'm guessing that in the Senate it was probably referred to Judiciary, and which is the proper place to be having these discussions. Our discussion about brain development, children and youth certainly would suggest that life without parole would not make a lot of sense for somebody at the age of 16. But that is finally not this committee's decision. I think that is a Judiciary committee decision. So I would, almost in the nature of a re-referral, or possibly we could re-refer it without recommendation to Judiciary. So at least the discussion would be taking place there.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, it goes to Judiciary.
Representative Winkler, would you like to make that motion?
Well, so Madam Chair, and be interested if the author would find this acceptable, I would move that we amend the motion to refer the bill to Judiciary without recommendation.
That's okay. Fine.
All right, let's...
Madam Chair, like I've said all along, I don't think this is ready for the floor of the House yet.
Okay. Representative Mulroy renews his motion to move House File 1217 to Judiciary without recommendation. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay?
No.
Motion passes.
If the combination PDF license rules. Why? Why?
That wasn't passed on.
Are we done?
I got Representative Fisher?
I have HHS,
civil law.
The last one.
Chair will move House File 1020 and goes to GovOps, is my understanding.
Correct. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you. First of all, I have a flyer or a handout of a supportive letter, if I could have the page.
He's behind you over there.
You pass this out. What this bill does is create the opportunity for a task force to adult what is happening to our youth as they hit into early adulthood. One of the things that I found, I currently work with a homeless youth population at a homeless youth shelter. One of the things that a number of years ago that happened is they did the Runaway Homeless Youth Act, where they got together a number of players to see what was working, what wasn't in the system, bringing people together and finding out what could be corrected and make government not only more efficient, but also figure out how to better connect youth to get better outcomes going forward. And over the years since that, they've had some great progresses, but one of the things that I've been seeing anecdotally, and I've been hearing from other people, particularly throughout the field, is that as they start approaching the age 21, that it seems that there's times that they're not really fully connected and making it as they come out. I see a lot of youth who've hit 21 and not really connecting with the opportunities that are out there, not always connecting with the services so that they'll be successful once they are done in our types of situations, and the support situations are out there. We seem to be in our society, we've got these barriers that kind of come up at 18 that are kind of arbitrarily set, then we hit again at 21, and we found at 18 that we were having some problems, had a task force come together to set to address it. Now we're seeing that at 21, we're seeing some of the same situations. We've got a number of governmental agencies that are willing to come together who would like to take a look at it from a number of purposes. Number one, trying to make sure that our youth are staying connected into different areas. Number two is making sure that we're having great outcomes. Right now, we're kind of relying a lot on some anecdotal evidence that we're seeing, but we're also having some feeling that we're not always being successful because they're turning 21 and aging out when it seems that they still need those supportive services a little bit longer, but they're kind of going from the last of the, what I would call the minor system to the adult system, and we still it feels like we have disconnect. What we want to do is, as we're going forward, is make sure that the parties in the, not only in state government, but also in different agencies are coming together, and that's one of the things I would like to let the committee know, that as this goes over to government ops, there's going to be a change coming up from two areas. Number one, the Department of Health is interested in becoming part of this because they see some opportunities where they might be able to learn and do things better. Number two, more importantly, is including communities of color, those that are at our disadvantage. They'd like to be at the table to make sure that we're having greater successes there. And that's part of the reason that we're bringing this forward, so that we can take a look how we're doing things in government right now and how we can do things better, not only with government, but with the partners that we have all in the community to improve the success rate for youth who are coming through and are at our great risk in our population. Do you have any questions that I could help with today?
Representative Fisher, I was just going to comment that, yes, we need to catch up, and, you know, we sometimes think we're pretty up on things here, and I remember several years ago being at an NCSL conference in Kentucky where they were already a leader in the country on this, what you're bringing up now here, so we need to start catching up. And for those that don't know it, Representative Fisher runs a homeless shelter, so he's very understanding of these issues. But does anybody have any questions on this? Okay, then I will renew my motion to pass House File 1020 and refer to GovOps. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, committee.
Then we're adjourned.